Is your money not sure what to do with itself right now? At Ally, they'll help it save for the future with their smart savings tools. Bucket your money for the things that matter most. Analyze your spending and save automatically. All on top of a competitive rate. For all things money, you deserve an Ally. Visit ally.com/savings for more info. Ally, do it right. Ally Bank, member FDIC.
The pride, passion, and pageantry of college football lives here. This is the Paul Feinbaum Show, Hour 3 Podcast.
And we welcome you back. And we talked with Harris English the other day about the difficulties of playing golf right now in the era of COVID. And it did not seem to affect our next guest. Will Gordon is the 19 SEC Player of the Year from Vanderbilt University. And he currently, I just looked over, is tied for the lead at the Travelers in Hartford with none other than Phil Mickelson. The fact that Will got in the tournament is an interesting story. But first of all, Will, congratulations. Thanks for joining us. This, I know it's only Friday, but this has already turned out to be probably one of the more memorable weeks of your career. Good afternoon.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Appreciate you having me. Pretty cool for me to be SEC player and athlete. We're always watching your show, so I appreciate you having me on.
Well, thank you. I mentioned you're tied for the lead right now with Phil, and I mean, just being mentioned in the same breath with one of the iconic golfers of all time has to be really cool. But let's talk about, first of all, how you ended up playing this week, because I have not heard the story. I knew there's because of the situation, things are a little bit different. How did you get in?
Yeah, they Andy Bassett and Nathan Grube, the two tournament directors over at Travelers, were kind enough to give me a sponsor's invitation, which is basically the tournament has, you know, a handful of spots to give away to guys that aren't in the tournament. And so really, really fortunate to get that opportunity. But, yeah, trying to take advantage this week. And like you said, to be up there with some guys I look up to and looking forward to going out there and competing against them and trying to beat them.
I mean, you're very young in your career, so obviously, sponsor's exemption is nice, but I'm interested when you get into a tournament like this. You're a competitive guy, of course. Your record is exemplary, but what are your expectations when you start off from that position?
Yeah, I think like you said, I'm only a year out of school, but this is my eighth start out there, and I've had some good finishes so far, and it's allowed me to kind of gain that confidence to believe I can compete at the top. And I think college golf has proven lately, especially within the last year, that the top guys are ready to go out there and compete. So it's good that some validation is coming.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm interested, before we get too deep into what's ahead for the weekend, we had Harris English on the other day, and he told us a little bit about some of the, you know, the challenges right now. I mean, the PGA was at the vanguard of coming back, and I'm sure the regulations and the stipulations you have to go through are pretty stiff. What are they like, just dealing with COVID and what you can and can't do?
Yeah, I mean, the tour's handled it really well. It's been really strict ever since we showed up. I showed up on Monday, and first thing I did was get tested, and I wasn't allowed to go inside until I got my results back. And so once I got those positive results back, you know, everybody's practicing good social distancing measures, and caddies are carrying around wipes to wipe off the rakes and pins. And I think the tour's done a really good job of keeping everybody aware, and everybody seems to be on the same page of just trying to make the best effort to keep the tour moving forward without too many COVID cases popping up. And I think it's been pretty successful so far.
Well, I know golf is a collegial sport. It's competitive, of course, but there's a lot of backslapping and fist bumping and shaking hands. I mean, do you have to ingrain that into your mind that you can't do what you have always done?
Oh yeah, it's super weird. I mean, like, even with your caddy, you're not giving any fist bumps, not shaking hands within the round. Everybody kind of walks toward each other at the end of the round, like because we're so accustomed to shaking hands, where everybody kind of walks toward each other and then does kind of the back pedal and gives some air elbows or air fist pumps. And yeah, it's definitely a change, but I think everybody's kind of understanding that's the new normal, at least for distant future. So we're just trying to make the most of it.
I want to talk a little bit about your experiences. Certainly, I mentioned being SEC Player of the Year. Your experiences at Vanderbilt were pretty positive. I know you've been playing golf a long time. I mean, you just don't roll out of bed and become a PGA touring professional. But go back to those years in Nashville, and how did that help shape you for what you're doing now?
Yeah, I think our golf program at Vandy was kind of I know these words aren't typically associated with golf, but like tough and resilient. We were really focused on the kind of the mental and emotional part of golf and becoming really tough competitors and kind of leaning into that part of yourself as an athlete. And I think that's what Coach Limbaugh and Gator Todd, son of Richard Todd, who actually played quarterback at
Alabama. I know Gator, yeah.
Yeah, so Gator and Coach Limbaugh, who also coached Alabama, they were just awesome mentors and able to kind of shape my mentality and kind of help me believe in myself, because after I got out last year, you kind of, all that structure goes away, and that's the hardest part of becoming a professional, I found out. Those guys really prepared us, and Vanderbilt was an awesome place to kind of had a really good balance of school, golf, and Nashville. So it was an awesome 4 years.
You grew up just north of Charlotte and Davidson, which is a pretty strong golfing area. And when did you? At what age did you? Do you remember having a club in your hand?
Yeah, I mean, I remember having a club in my hand probably, you know, at 3 or 4. but I was one of those guys that just loved all the different sports, and you know, I wanted to play basketball and play in the NBA, and then you know, the height thing kind of got in the way. So kind of once high school came around, I turned my focus toward golf, and kind of fell in love with it even more once I started to get pretty good at it. But yeah, I mean, being around Davidson and watching Davidson College basketball growing up was just such a cool.
You probably knew you would never be the best player in Davidson history if you played basketball.
Say what?
I said you probably knew pretty early on you would never be the best player in basketball in Davidson history if you played.
Yeah, that's a pretty safe bet. once Steph rolled through there was a little to no question that one was gonna hold for a while.
In terms of this weekend, and I want to get back to that because I know that golfers, we're watching Phil right now, and he's struggling on the course. So you may end up having the outright lead, but you know it's not over. You've been on this tour all year. You've played out there, but it's a unique position. How do you approach the next two rounds, especially after just blistering the course today?
Yeah, I think just believing in myself and continuing to believe that I'm good enough to be out here. I think I've been in positions like this before, not at this stage, but I'm just going to kind of lean on those experiences I've had in the past, the ones where I have converted and the ones that I haven't, and just go out and try to put my best foot forward. And there's a lot of external stuff that, even without fans, there's a lot of external stuff that, you know, goes into this, and just trying to minimize the noise and focus in on what I'm doing is going to be key over the next couple of days.
You got Rory McIlroy right behind you. I mean, I'm sure growing up, Phil Mickelson, Rory McIlroy, I know that you can't let anything get to you. You played competitive golf your whole life, but and you've also played with a lot of these guys, but I mean, do you ever catch yourself like shaking your head like right now going, this is pretty unbelievable?
Yeah, I think like it would be almost me trying to be cliche if I said I wasn't. You know, I was at lunch today and I was sitting there and I looked up and, you know, like you said, Phil was a couple strokes behind me and Rory's a couple strokes behind me. And that's a cool feeling. It's a feeling that I want to embrace and I want to, you know, continue to capitalize on. And realizing that those guys are people I look up to but not people I'm afraid of, I think is a good distinction.
Well, listen, I certainly wish you well. You're a competitive guy. You want to go out there and win, but you're in a unique position right now. And I know that sleep may not be easy tonight, but we'll let you get going. And thanks for coming on. Congratulations again on the 62, and all the best this weekend.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you very much. What an amazing story. Will Gordon shooting a 62 today, 8-under. He is currently tied for the lead with Phil Mickelson at the Travelers in Hartford. We'll take a break. Change gears a little bit. When we return, we'll talk to the rather young mayor of the city of Montgomery on what he has been dealing with. He's the son of one of the state's most famous leaders, a man who once worked with Dr. Martin Luther King in Montgomery, Alabama. We'll talk to Mayor Stephen Reed when we come back.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
And we welcome you back. What an interesting day it has been. Thanks for everyone for being here. You may know that Montgomery, Alabama is the capital of Alabama, but that's only part of the story. It was also the first capital of the Confederacy during the Civil War. It's also this place where Rosa Parks changed the world during the Montgomery bus boycott. It's also where a young pastor named Dr. Martin Luther King lived and raised a family. And in November, history was also made when our next guest, Stephen Reed, became the first African-American mayor in that city's history. And Mayor Reed joins us now. Mayor, thank you so much for your time. I've been watching what you've been doing, not only during this pandemic, but during the last 4 weeks since George Floyd. And it's just such a great honor to have you on the program. Good afternoon.
Paul, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
I don't even know where to begin, because you grew up in a very interesting house. Your father is one of the most distinguished politicians and people over the last 50 years in that state. Someone that came in and around and right after the era of Dr. King. And before we even get to today, what was it like growing up with so much history in your house and in your community?
You know, it was a tremendous blessing. You know, I don't think growing up we understood what we were witnessing. If, you know, we had Mrs. Coretta Scott King, who would come to the house when she was coming to Montgomery. She was from the same area that my mother's from, which is Perry County, a part of Alabama just above Selma. And to have people like Reverend Jesse Jackson and Reverend Dr. Joseph Lowry and people come by the house, and Ambassador Andrew Young, so many of those people telling stories about things that to them were just, you know, still fresh in their mind, you know, 10, 15 years prior to that. It was a tremendous opportunity that I didn't appreciate at the time, and only probably began to appreciate, you know, much later in life, some of the stories and some of the conversations that I was able to be a witness to.
And here we are again, Mayor, in 2020, we're talking about Confederate battle flags. We're talking about the Civil War. We're talking about all the things that divided this country that your father and so many other people that you just got through mentioning have worked and gave their lives for. I'm so curious about your thoughts and maybe conversations with your dad and others about this time we're living in right now that you're playing a big part in.
You know, it's very interesting, you know, how this has come about. You know, and my conversations with them over the last month or so, it's been one of those things that the movement for freedom and justice has always been ongoing. It never has stopped. And, you know, there have been ebbs and flows to it, and many people can point to, you know, different parts of history, whether that was the desegregation of the armed forces, whether that was Brown v. Board of Education, the Montgomery bus boycott, you know, the March on Washington, go down the list. There have been so many, you know, pivotal moments, but I think the movement has always been ongoing. And you know, just kind of listening to the elders in the village, as I like to refer to them, has been enlightening to me, because for them, this is something when we think about the flag in Mississippi, when we think about college athletes in South Carolina pushing back on the names on buildings, on statues, but more importantly on the systems that those statues represent, you know, it shows us that we still have a long way to go, but we've also made tremendous progress. When I looked at the protests after the killing of George Floyd across the world, we saw multiracial, multicultural people marching, saying Black Lives Matter. That's progress. And those are things that I think many of those who kind of were on the front lines of the movement, you know, certainly understand and have appreciated. In my response to them, I just tell them, hey, I'm just carrying on what you all did. You did the heavy lifting. You know, it's just my time to carry the baton at this moment in the race. And we're trying to do everything we can, I think, as a community, not only here in Montgomery or the state of Alabama, but across the country, to make things better and to really bring about, you know, that beloved community that Dr. King talked about.
And Mayor, we've had conversations here. Everyone's had conversations that are uncomfortable, but important and necessary. And I wonder your view of it, because sometimes it doesn't feel. I know we've made so much progress. I mean, I've lived through a lot of this. You haven't. You've heard about it and experienced it as a young kid. But where do we go from here?
I think people want to see action. I think they want to see deliberate and intentional change. And I think that's why the cries and the yells of the protesters were so loud. I think they really want to see us not only talk about equality, but to do things that bring about equity throughout our nation and to really make sure this country lives up to its ideals. They want to see political leaders like myself at the local level, state leaders like governors and federal leaders like congressmen and senators really do things that are going to make things better for them and the way they view America and the way they view the world. And I don't think they view the world much like previous generations did, whether that be through art, whether that just be through involvement of technology and the way information and relationships are exchanged these days. There's an optimism there. I think the people who are really dimming that optimism are us and not having the courage and not having the leadership to speak very truthfully and to speak truth to power about systemic racism, to speak about the injustice that's involved in our systems of education, of economics, of healthcare. Things along those lines, I believe when you put them side by side and you look at them through the lens of whether it's Black, white, people of color, brown, Hispanic, and so forth, what the protesters have been telling us here in Montgomery is, listen, we've heard the talks. We don't need another meeting. We don't need another roundtable discussion. We want to see policy. And I think that's what we're hearing from the athletes as well. I think that's why LeBron James, who I think has been the leader of this, whether it be professional athletes or the college athletes, have been pushing back and using their platforms and saying, you know what? We have our own following. We have our own megaphone to use, and we're going to change things now because we actually have leverage. And that's what I think society wants to see us do right now, Paul, is to bring about the policy and implement the cultural changes that are needed and to be truthful about the history of this country and its original sin, which is slavery, and to really eradicate some of those issues and to show some growth in that.
Chatting with the mayor of Montgomery, Stephen Reed. Mayor, not only have we all, you in particular, been dealing with this, I've followed very closely your own battles in Montgomery about this pandemic, especially with local leaders, local officials there about trying to deal with it equitably. For a couple of weeks, Montgomery was certainly all over the news, and now everyone seems to be watching these numbers rise. Let's talk for a second about where you are and where everyone is, because this is a sports show, as you well know. You're a sports fan, and we all want to see sports in the fall, but the path there is not a straight line.
It is not a straight line. You know, we host a kind of a kickoff classic, much smaller than the ones you normally cover, Paul, on your show, with the neutral site games, where we would normally be talking about Austin Peay and Central Arkansas playing here in Montgomery at the end of August. And there's some question about whether or not we're going to be able to host that game because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And what we're dealing with is we have to deal with some of the measures, not only that we have to put in place, but the unpredictability of outbreaks and of spikes. My alma mater, Morehouse College, where I lettered in football, a small Division II college just canceled its football season today. So we understand that collegiate athletics is going to be impacted. And in a city like Montgomery, where we have been a hot spot for much of the last 30 days or so, we had to mandate masks to be worn in public. And that was the only way we could start to try to get our arms around declining, you know, COVID-19 numbers, ICU beds, and hospitalizations, because this is having a tremendous impact on our community, but it's having a disproportionate impact on the black community here in Montgomery, where over 70% of the people who have been infected are black, because many of them are working in frontline employment. Many of them are suffering from communal spread, and 90% of the people who are on ICU ventilators were black. So we have, again, a situation where we can see the access to our healthcare system often is impacted by one's race, and the impact of even something like this comes down to race and economic lines. So as the mayor of the city, and as many of my colleagues are dealing with across this country in their own cities, we have to make sure we're looking out for the health of our communities even before we can champion and promote those things that bring us together like sports, even those things that really unify us and really serve as getaways for many of us to rally around our favorite team and our favorite sport, whether that be baseball, football, or basketball. We have to make sure that we're doing things that are probably outside of the purview most of us signed up for as mayors, which is becoming public health officials and trying to share that information with people who are skeptical of the data and who are skeptical of medical experts that at any other time they would listen to if the doctor told them, hey, here's what you need to do to lower that blood pressure, or here's what you need to do in order, you know, to be a little bit healthier. But for some reason in this pandemic, we have politicized it somewhat, and that, I think, has stalled our progress, and I think that's why we're seeing, you know, cities and states around the country take, you know, immediate action as it relates to trying to stem the tide of the rising numbers of COVID cases.
And, Mayor, I know you had, I was following the story in the news a couple of weeks ago that your own, I think it was your own council, I may have the story wrong, you know, did not want to mandate masks, and then I think you finally pushed back. I lived in Alabama 30 years, so I think I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask you anyway, since you're the mayor of the capital of Alabama. But why is there such a resistance and a reluctance to wear a mask when every medical professional tells you it will stop the spread and it's also respectful to the people you're around?
Paul, you know, you don't have to have a Vanderbilt degree to figure that out. I know your wife has one, and I have one as well. And I'm proud to follow Will Gordon, and glad he shot 62 today as a Commodore as well. You know, it comes down, unfortunately, I think, to politics. I think it comes down to philosophy, and unfortunately, often that comes down in the South to one's racial background. And I don't understand why a health emergency becomes political, much less racial. But unfortunately, I think some of the leaders starting at the very top at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue have made it that way. And I can't think of a more perfect time for the country to be united in fighting against an invisible enemy like a virus like this, but for the politicization of medicine and science and data. And I don't really get it, but it comes about. And I had someone tell me, well, you know what, Mayor, you know, I don't want to wear a mask, and I don't believe you should be able to tell me that I should have to wear a mask. And I said, well, I shouldn't have to tell you that you have to wear pants when you go into the grocery store, but you do. So I said, you know, some of these things, you're right, we shouldn't have to tell people, but we're having to repeatedly go over this because of the skepticism that exists. and unfortunately because of the polarization of our society, and that's a problem.
Mayor Reed, whose alma mater, Morehouse, announced they are not having activities, fall football or any other activities this year, but we're hoping that your graduate degree in Vanderbilt does play. Mayor, I joke about sports, but the subjects that we've talked about here are so serious, and I would love to have you back sometime. Really appreciate you making the time.
Paul, thanks again for having me. Love to come back. Love the show. And love what you do. Thanks so much for being on the forefront of so many of these issues and flushing out a lot of the topics of the day that we all need to discuss and we all need to make sure we act on as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mayor. All the best. What an incredible conversation with the mayor of Montgomery, Alabama, Mayor Stephen Reed, joining us from the Alabama Capitol. We'll take a break. Much more to come on this program. It has been a wild 2.5 hours, and we are back after this.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
You're not worth a flip.
We welcome you back, and it's great to have everyone here, and we'll continue with more phone calls. We have had a load of guests, but a little time here finally to get you on the board. Mark is up next in Alabama. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Hey, I appreciate you taking my call. The interview with the mayor of Montgomery. Did you happen to think about the apple falling far from the tree?
I guess you're talking about his father, Joe?
Yes. Of course, you understand they ripped his name off the Alabama State basketball arena.
I did not realize that. I've met Joe Reed. He's very prominent. He was the head of the Alabama State board, I believe. But my 7 years away from Alabama, I've lost some of the fine print.
All right. I don't know. I just listened to him, and every other sentence was about race. And,
well,
you know,
but hold on a second. Every question was about race too. So I didn't invite him to come in here to talk about, whether Tom Brady is going to win a Super Bowl, and he brought race in. My questions were about race because that's the topic in the country right now. I happen to think I thought he was a phenomenal guest, but again, I don't know as much about Alabama as you probably do. Dan is up next in California. Hello, Dan.
That's
thanks for the call.
Paul?
Hey, Dan. Good afternoon.
This is the first time I've ever called in to anybody, but you, the people that call your show are so nice in general.
Well, thank you.
But I have an issue that I'm not very good at this, but the Black Lives Matter movement, to me, it's positive in so many ways, but what bothers me immensely, there's a huge difference between the organization Black Lives Matter, which to me is a hate group and then a Marxist group, and I think well-meaning people that want to do the right thing are misled. They send their money in, and
I need to ask you a question because I've heard this line used about Marxist and whatever. What are you basing that on?
You know, the chant, what do we want, dead cops? I want to see somebody like Richard Sherman, that I think is a great guy all mm-hmm. around, and Jordan, who's great. I'd like to see them.
My question is this: to me, I've seen a lot of young people join this movement, maybe for the first time they've ever belonged to anything or cared about social issues. So, I mean, I'm concentrating on that. I know the politics of it. I watch TV. And I also know when somebody frames a description of an organization, where it's coming from. I'm in the media. I'm part of the national media, the local media. I know where all the talking points are. But if young, I cover sports. If young college football players are proud to display a shirt that says Black Lives Matter, and it has inspired them to become more socially active. I don't know really what the purpose of bringing some of the things that you and others have brought up. But again, I may be really naive here. Sure I am. Chuck is up next in Tupelo, Mississippi. Hello, Chuck. Hey, Chuck, you there?
Hey, Paul. How are you this afternoon?
I am doing great. Thank you.
All right. News article just came out this afternoon. Mississippi Today News said the Mississippi legislature is going, House of Representatives is going to vote in the morning to take up changing the flag.
Right.
And that's news because we didn't know whether they were going to vote on it before they recessed or not.
Well, I think it's a good thing, and I'm hopeful that they take it off the docket by voting it, because I think it's a story that does nobody in Mississippi a lick of good by continuing the conversation. Hey, thank you so much for the call. Logan is in North Carolina. Hello, Logan.
Hi, Paul. How's it going today?
It's going well. Thank you.
Great show. I was going to ask if you could put Marxist and subtitles by my name every time I call in going forward, because I just realized I was a Marxist. I was going to call in about a couple things. I saw the Will Cain interview yesterday.
Right.
And it just seems like that guy, I mean, I don't know if you're friends with him. I don't want to disparage him, but it seems like the whole time he's been on ESPN, he's been auditioning for Fox News. So when I found out he was going there, it made sense.
Well, even though he will not tell you where he's going, I will. He's going to Fox News.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. And, you know, he's up against you. I mean, that's a lose-lose situation, obviously. So, I mean, good for him. We wish him the best, whatever. But I did want to ask you, there was a caller that called in earlier, and they talked about Joe Paterno. And it got me thinking about, you know, coaches that I was born in 78. And, you know, I saw Bobby Bowden and I saw Joe Paterno. And the way they went out was just really rough. And I just wonder, like, to get your opinion, because I think you were covering Alabama football.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, what I remember, you know, the only thing I remember about Bear Bryant was his – Sunday morning show or Sunday afternoon show, you know, with Golden Plate. And yeah. So I just wanted to, do you think, just, you know, your opinion, do you think you overstayed or do you think he
do I think, do I think Coach Bryant stayed too long? It's interesting. I show you how silly I was at Coach Bryant's announcement that he was retiring. I asked him pretty much that same question. Again, I was in my early 20s and I was pretty full of myself. I can't believe I asked it, but I asked him if he regretted not retiring after he won the 315th game the year before. That was when he broke Amos Alonzo Stagg's record. And he said he didn't.
Right.
And I will tell you this, on his last day, the day of his last game, I was part of a group of reporters who were able to go up to his suite and have a farewell interview. And I say this, the main reason I went, it wasn't like I was close to him. I wasn't. But my boss was. And my boss took me along, I think, to do the heavy lifting, meaning taking the notes and writing the story. And Coach Bryant said something very interesting. Somebody casually asked him, this wasn't somewhat of a off the record, on the record. You just kind of had to decide what you wanted to use. And he said the reason why he stayed and did not retire the year earlier was because had he stepped down, he said he was going to affect so many people, not only his coaching staff, but their families, the personnel. He said he couldn't do it. He couldn't walk away and see all those people lose their job. I thought it was a remarkable statement.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you for sharing that, Paul. I'm too young to remember most of them,
Logan, I will say this to you: coaches don't know they get so ingrained. Bobby Bowden, I thought, had the worst farewell. He really believed, because he had put that school on the map, that he could stay as long as he wanted. And unfortunately, his effectiveness had worn out. Joe Paterno stayed 10 years past the time he should have stayed. But it's hard to tell someone when they're the most powerful person on that campus that it's time to go. The president of Penn State, I'll say this and we have to go to a break, Graham Spanier, went to Joe Paterno's house about 10 years before he finally was forced out. And you know what? He went there to tell him, Joe, you need to retire. And Paterno essentially threw the president of the university out of his house, and he stayed 10 more years. We're up against a break. Back with much, much more.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
We're back in a couple more minutes in hour number three, and Augie is up next in New Orleans. Augie?
Happy Friday, Paul. How are you doing?
We're doing great.
So what do you think about Morehouse? They were the first one, right?
They're
first.
Yeah, they will not be the last of the small schools. I think the budgets and the testing is simply going to overwhelm a lot of smaller schools and really mid-sized schools as well.
Well, I'm sure Kirk Herbstreit is saying, see, they're already starting to fall. But glad to hear that Winston's doing okay there at LSU. But just goes to show you, when you're young and dumb and stupid, like we all were at one time, right? We never thought things would affect us, but it's a hell of a way to have to grow up these days. I probably would have been right there with him at the bars. So hopefully more people will heed his warning. But, Paul, you were talking about coaches who didn't want to leave the sidelines. What about Bill Snyder?
Yeah, you know, by the way, in fairness, Paterno and Bowden were in this grumpy old man battle to be the winningest coach, and neither could see reality because of that. Bill Snyder retired, and then they brought him back, if you remember. And then he stayed too long.
Over Cleveland of college football.
Yeah.
So, but Joe Paul, I thought he was going to have to start coming out in one of the little rascals, you know, the little scooters that you see the older folks riding around Walmart.
Yeah, no, I've got one of those.
Hey, there you go. You got a license plate for it? Are you short?
It just says Paul, P-A-W-W-L-L, something like that.
But, Paul, speaking of the bear, there's one guy in college football history that basically was the Bears' number one victim. And since I'm talking, you know who I think that is, right?
I'm guessing it's Charlie Mack.
Charlie Mack. But you said something once that led me to believe that you knew Charlie Mack and you had a fond relationship with him. Is that
true? My first job, I covered Charlie Mack's final season at LSU. And he was really a friendly guy, a likable guy. He just wasn't he was a good coach. Not a great coach.
And that's why I always thought Les Miles was son of Charlie Mack.
Thinking of that. I mean, Les was, I will say this with all due respect to Charlie Mack's family, Les Miles had the potential to be a much better coach than he was, but his stubbornness always got in the way. We're out of time. One more hour to go. We hope you'll stick around.
Did you know Geico's now offering an extra 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies? That's 15% on top of what Geico could already save you. So what are you waiting for? Your teenager to help around the house?
Okay, Mom, I emptied the dishwasher, vacuumed the basement, and folded the sheets out of the dryer.
Wait, what?
Oh, and next, I'm going to clean Mitten's litter box.
Are we in some kind of prank show or something? That's a camera, isn't it?
There's never been a better time to switch to Geico. Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Limitations apply. Visit geico.com for details.